there's this feeling that artists are gatekeeping artistry and creativity, when the truth is nobody's gatekeeping artistry or creativity. You, anybody, can decide, I'm going to learn art right now. I don't feel comfortable or confident in drawing a figure. Well, you can learn how. You don't even need to pay money. There's all these free resources now. The internet has never been more accessible in terms of classes, YouTube, WikiHow. I mean, it just takes practice and discipline and the wherewithal to say, I have a creative idea, instead of being frustrated and basing its manifestation on external sources. I can learn ways and find ways to express it myself. But in this modern world, we're always looking for shortcuts and quick answers. And
awesome. We're here at last.
At last. Here we are.
We are. You've been very busy, and we both have, actually, ironically. And so it's nice to be able to cut some time out of our lives to get to know one another a bit more. And I'm really thankful that you're willing to share a bit of time with us and the audience and everybody here. So yeah, it was nice to meet you. We met at IMAX, I think, right?
We did. That was nice, wasn't it? What a cool spot. Like, wish we had an excuse to go to IMAX more often, just pop by their headquarters. They got such a nice space.
Yeah, it was honestly for me, it was very, very surreal just being there. And when I was there, I felt like I was amongst people I want to be around. If that makes sense. Yeah.
It does. It was a good group. And they also just had an IMAX camera just kind of sitting there in the lobby.
Oh, yeah.
And you could look through it, but you were sort of like, can we take this out? Like, this is just sitting here. Like, can we go use this? I mean, I feel like there aren't a lot of IMAX cameras out there in the world. Like,
quite rare.
Let's get this rolling. Let's get some film rolling through this thing.
That'd anyway, be awesome. Yeah.
It was quite fun.
Just got to get Nolan's approval and we can do it.
Well, yeah. Or the opposite. You start with it and then you get a call like, hey, actually, Nolan needs it, so go ahead and give that back to us, please.
Okay, well, we will meet Nolan on set.
That'd be great. That'd be real nice. I met him the other day, actually.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was at the Academy Nominees Luncheon. Not that I'm nominated, but I was there as a guest for one of our VFX nominees for the creator, Andrew Roberts, ILM on-set supervisor. And it just happened to bump right into him, and we had a nice little chat.
Wow.
He was very, very nice, very complimentary of the film, which was sweet. Ah. He sort of joked at the end that next time we should shoot on film. But I don't know how much he was joking, but it was funny.
He's serious.
It's a fun exchange. Yeah.
Yeah. He's championing it for sure. I think we would all do it if there was the affordability of it and the aspect of it. But I guess that's a chicken and egg. That's so cool. That's cool that you got to meet. I'm imagining he's an influence to you. Yeah.
I'm a fan. I have been for a while. I still think his best film is The Prestige, I think.
Yes, same. Prestige and Memento are my two favorites of his. Yeah. I love Prestige. The book is really fantastic, too. I think the book is really well translated by the film, and I think it's so well done through it all. So
super cool.
Yeah.
I never read it.
It's good. I mean, it kind of crosses over really well, which is great.
No David Bowie, though.
Yeah, unfortunately.
That was a film invention and a good one, a brilliant one.
Yeah, this is like the thing that, I mean, I know we'll talk a bit about it, but the alchemy of filmmaking and the serendipitous energy that occurs when, you know, you have an idea and you manifest it through just innovation and things kind of come to be. And that, I mean, that's a pretty interesting thing that Tesla was done by Bowie. I couldn't think of another better person. And for some reason, when I watched it, wouldn't imagine that was him until it was him, and then it just was perfectly fitting, you know?
That's exactly, it's a perfect description.
Yeah, perfect. It's a really good, great casting. Okay, you've done a lot of interviews. I haven't watched all of them. I watched some of them because I'm like, okay, I don't want to repeat these questions, but it's kind of
Yes.
hard if people haven't watched those.
Yes, exactly. And it's an impossible task to watch all of them because it really is too much. I
You've done a great
sorry if
job.
anyone did,
You've
but
done a
yes.
great job saturating, basically, and like getting your name out there and using this as a wonderful place to expose who you are and what you do and your passion for things. And
Thank you.
yeah, all interviews are so wonderful, and I urge anybody that enjoys this conversation for sure check this out and also follow what you're doing on Instagram. You've been doing these beautiful like breakdowns, which is really wonderful too for aspiring filmmakers or filmmakers in general. I can tell that you have this affinity for filmmaking. So let's go back to the origin. Let's I know you mentioned some in other interviews, some inspirations. One of them was watching Star Wars and just kind of being hit by the lightning of what Star Wars is. Can you, yeah, there you go.
Not on purpose, by the way. I just happened to be wearing this shirt
Yeah.
today because it's laundry day, so
Ah,
here
perfect.
we are.
Well, Star Wars is a catalyst for many of us, myself
Yes.
included.
Yeah.
What is it about the universe of Star Wars that sparked that to you, and how did that kind of how what did it do to you? Like how?
I think there was just something about the endless possibility of it. When th this is a very specific time and place that you sort of had to be in, and I think you're probably a little older than me, so
I'm 5 years older than you. You're
so
35,
actually,
right?
yes.
Yeah.
So you may have actually been right in this window, but there was a window of Star Wars fandom in the 90s where it was in between trilogies. The originals had come out before I was born. So I had only seen them on VHS and on Laserdisc. My uncle had a Laserdisc player.
That's awesome.
I loved visiting him, and then he owned the trilogy on Laserdisc, so this was in the early 90s.
That's pretty rare too.
Oh
Laserdisc is
yes,
awesome.
very much so. It's the
Yeah.
precursor to DVD, really. But
Yeah.
and then of course the prequel trilogy came out starting in 99. So there's a gap in the 90s after the kind of Star Wars was pretty much dead in the 80s. And then in the 90s there was this thing called the Expanded Universe, the EU as it's referred to by the fans. And what it was it was a series of Lucasfilm licensed and approved novels, video games, card games, board games, computer games, comic books, graphic novels, toys, like everything
Yeah.
that had basically, like, with not George's, but with Lucasfilm, I don't even know who was running Lucasfilm at the time, with their approval, they had licensed out the name and idea of Star Wars and the characters to basically anybody who wanted to take a stab at it. And these writers basically took it on themselves to like continue the story. And there were all of these novels that had an internal continuity with the previous novels and then the ones that came after. But this was not a coordinated effort like it is now, like in the MCU or other corporate structures or the current Star Wars universe where it's all kept by, some guy that keeps track of the continuity. It was just a bunch of fans, basically, talented fans, not nobodies, who wanted to continue the stories and all had this tacit agreement with each other that they are all collectively contributing to the lore and expanding the lore of the universe and building on what George had planted. And what's so great about the original trilogy that sets it apart from pretty much anything else, certainly at the time, and what made it so special and such a pop cultural juggernaut, and what I think inspired me as a young kid, before I started reading the Expanded Universe books and all that, was that the world feels so lived in because the way George designed the films is there's so much detail in every frame, but nothing is explained. Like you just sort of live in this world, you're transported. Like going back to A New Hope. Why, what is a moisture farm? What are these towers that they have sprung up in the desert? What's with their house that's like in this subterranean pit, and how do they live? How do they sleep? Why is the milk blue? what is that strange lizard creature that is roaming around? Like, you drive through Mos Eisley, what are all these speeders and things and bikes and technologies and ships? And you go to the cantina, there's all these aliens. You see one shot of each. Like, they're not, they don't dwell on anything. There's just, there's the bat looking guy and the werewolf looking guy and the guy that looks like a bug and the guy that has this weird shaped head. You don't see any, it's like, you're not explained. You're not, the world isn't built in by through description. It's just built through detail that, and you imagine, you can just imagine a whole universe outside of the frame. That's what was unique about Star Wars. And that's what inspired the expanded universe. And that's what inspired, I think, all these filmmakers like myself, like you, like everybody who like Gareth, like J.J. Abrams, like, you know, you name it, who were just so taken by and inspired by Star Wars is because of that. And I think as a kid, I had a runaway imagination, and I was just constantly coming up with all sorts of scenarios and stories and Legos. I was very into that. And my friend and I would always build things and strange contraptions and ships and vehicles and come up with storylines and write things. And I was a big drawer. I would draw and sketch and doodle all the time. And so I think that was, it all kind of dovetailed into this just boundless imagination. And I think Star Wars is like the ultimate expression of boundless imagination in cinema, at least for at a specific time, for a specific generation. So that plus the expanded universe and all of it, I think it just really, that's what got me into filmmaking, is because Star Wars is a film, and or the trilogy of films. So it was the manifestation of that imagination and that world building through cinema that I think unlocked my interest in it as an art form. And I liked other movies. I mean, I was big on Spielberg and Back to the Future, Indiana Jones, Jurassic Park, but those movies are quite finite. Like, they're self-contained, but there was something about the universe of Star Wars that was just so inspiring, kind of endlessly so. And, yeah, that's my strange answer to that question.
I love that. Well, I mean, there's so many things, and I'm taking notes as you're explaining your process and kind of how this had an effect on you. The activation of imagination through these worlds is I think that's the catalyst, really, truly. When I revisit them still in my adult life, say I sit down and watch Empire Strikes Back or something, you know, every time I watch these films, I glean something different from it. You know, great films do that for you, and you can see them in different lights for very various versions of your life. And the last time I remember watching it, and I just watched sections of it, and I just went and got obsessed with the cinematography only. And I was like, I can't believe this is so wonderful and this and that. But then when I go back and just to be a kid and watch it, I think you're exactly right, where there's this world that's happening without explanation. It's just occurring. And all you want to do as a child is to go like, I want to play in this world because it's playing with my mind and I want to play with it back. And then this is where you have this extension of imagination and creativity. And then it becomes, this is why I think so many people lock on to Star Wars emotionally. And that's why it's kind of becomes controversial when it's not done the way that people would want it to be done potentially, you know? So,
well, yeah, I mean, that's a whole other thing, but, sure. But yeah, like obviously, I don't know. I personally don't have that attachment to it to that degree, but yeah, I think it comes from that same place. You're right. I think maybe that's like an extreme negative manifestation of that feeling, but
sure.
But yeah. Yeah.
Well, we all, I think there's an amount of ownership that people falsely think that they own certain things that they,
well, don't. There is. And I guess that's the part that I don't relate to, because I don't feel any ownership on Star Wars. It just feels inspirational to me, but you know, all I can do is react and respond to what is given. But also, like, the imagination is boundless, and I don't know why you would feel limited by what the studio is producing to limit your imagination in terms of what Star Wars is and could be. I guess that's like, it's just a very literal interpretation when people get angry about, like, oh, well, this isn't the way that I imagined it. It's like, well, it's because Star Wars doesn't belong to you in that way, you know?
That's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, like, at least I guess I should say, like, the the studio created material that exists in the Star Wars universe doesn't belong to you, but the idea of Star Wars belongs to everybody. But like, so you can do something, you can do whatever you want with that idea and with that imagination. Like, why are you limiting yourself to what the studio is putting out?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can imagine and do and think and create whatever you want. That's
yeah.
that inspires you. So it's just, that's the very literal mindset that is like, I can't create, or I don't feel like I can create. So I'm limited by what is created for me, but I do still feel an ownership of it. It's that's hard for me cyclical. To reconcile.
Yeah. You know? That becomes a bad cycle for sure. And that's also just, there's enough of that in the world, I suppose, you know? So, which is interesting. Yeah. You mentioned drawing. Do you still draw?
Not as much as I'd like to, but I did get back into painting recently.
Mm. Acrylics or oil or what?
Well, I used to paint acrylics, but I did recently get more into watercolors because it's just a little more portable.
Yeah.
So I just have a little watercolor sketchbook and a little palette, and I take it around with me when I travel.
That's cool.
So yeah, I've been trying to get back into that habit. I really used to draw and paint all the time.
Mm.
And it just sort of got replaced by other interests and manifestations of visual creativity. And I got into photography in middle school. My grandfather gave me his, he passed away, so he didn't give it to me, but I inherited his Minolta 35 millimeter stills camera. So I started taking stills and
that's beautiful.
Yeah. And then I bought a Canon digital Rebel. I haven't really looked back
the
since.
The gateway drug. Yeah.
Yeah. I've kind of been in the digital stills world since, but now I'm rocking the Fuji GFX, have been for a couple of years, and I love it.
Yeah,
medium format digital, and so I'm still very into photography, and then of course filmmaking just completely took over. So painting and drawing sort of fell by the wayside a little bit, but I'm trying to get back into it.
Do you know why it fell by? Is this because you just saturated with learning these new tools and, you know, career and all these things kind of?
Yeah, all of the above. And it's just time consuming. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
true.
The other thing I used to do as a kid is I would read before bed every night. Like I would read a book. And
you don't do that much anymore?
No, you get to high school and college and then adult life. And
yeah,
you just have to prioritize things. And reading is something I definitely deprioritize. I still do, but certainly not every day.
Yeah. It's so good for your brain though.
Oh, it's fantastic. So, yeah. I love it. I tend to do it when I'm on vacation, typically, because that's when I'm less sat. My brain is less saturated with the worries of the day to day.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I love reading. I'm surrounded by books in here, but I love reading. And I recently got a Kindle. I was one of those people that was like, oh, if it's not on paper, I can't read it, this and that. And then the moment I realized that actually it doesn't matter what the medium is, it's just as long as I'm accessing that part, you know? So that's been kind of interesting. So I can just lay in bed, because what was happening is I would have to turn on a light or something and it would disrupt my wife, but I wanted to read to go to sleep. So then I just got a Kindle. It made it less of a problem, so I could just lay there and read and then fall asleep. But usually the days that I am allowing myself at least 30 to 60 minutes of reading, something happens to me cerebrally that I kind of unlock a lot of things personally. It's interesting. And I
like that.
Five books at the same time too. So,
oh, that I can't do.
Yeah. I'll read like I'm reading a book about the history of Cambodia. It's very intense and very heavy. And then I'll jump to like Harry Potter or something to offset it. And then I'm reading Congo, Michael Crichton's Congo. And I'm like, this is so fun. Like, I just love going into the minds of a great writer. It's just like, this is so interesting. Like how imaginative you are and how you're solving all these things and how all this data kind of just falls into this narration, and it's really fantastic. So
That movie is batshit insane.
Yeah, the concept is insane too. I haven't watched the movie in a while, but
I rewatched it recently.
Oh, you did?
It's pretty bonkers.
Yeah.
I love it though. Tim Curry's accent, incredible.
Oh man, that's right. Tim Curry's in there. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some great choices being made in that movie. Just hilarious stuff, but it's good. It's a good movie.
Yeah, it's probably, I'll rewatch it again soon, because it's probably one of those films of that era where kind of things was going nuts and things were being translated in a rapid rate, and
Yeah, but underrated too, like sort of underappreciated. Mm. Like it's not considered a classic film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But maybe it should be.
Well, certain things age differently in time, right? You can't
Yes.
really perceive the value, especially with these things, instantaneously. Usually I say when something's accessible or loved instantly, it's something to be thought of, you know? It's like, I wonder if something's, I mean, I guess you could say that about Star Wars, but Star Wars is one of those things that's aged in its own way. I'm only bringing up Star Wars because this is the thing we talked about, but
Yes, exactly.
yeah, I'm just,
No, I completely agree.
yeah, art shifts and changes as humanity and culture shifts and changes, and perception is all, it's unquantifiable, really, truly. So you talked a little bit about inheriting your grandfather's camera. I think that's really beautiful, and I've heard this story through quite a few photographers where the equipment was passed down to the next generation of creators, and that's a beautiful thing. Do you still enjoy the process of just grabbing your camera and going outside and just taking photos for casual sake? Do you allow
Yes.
yourself that?
Not as much as I should. But
Okay.
yes, I do enjoy it. I do enjoy that a lot. It's just hard to find the time.
Yeah, this is actually, we should maybe dive into that. Come back to this, but these are things that I know you mentioned that, you know, reading or painting or drawing and these things. But right now, you're in a stage of your life and your career where you're doing other things that are saturating yourself. And is it hard to make time for things that you potentially would do on a casual basis or?
It is, and I think another thing that I've reflected on is, I'm very lucky. I managed to succeed in turning my passion and interest into a career.
Yeah.
And as a result, I spend a lot of time both practicing and thinking about the act and the art of image composition and capture. And I think as a result, I gain the artist's way, I think, has some good terminology that I find very helpful when talking about art and artistic expression. And one of them is the creative well, the concept of the creative well. And the creative well is something that you need to fill, but it's also something that you use. You draw water from it all the time in order to create. And I think that there are different processes for me, at least, that fill the well and draw from the well. And I spend a lot of time drawing from the well during my job, which is good. I mean, it's incredible. Like I said, I'm very fortunate and one of the lucky ones that actually managed to convert it into work so that I don't have to do something else in order to sustain my lifestyle or pay bills. I can do what I like in order to do that. But as a result, I definitely spend a lot of time drawing from the well when I'm working. And I feel very satisfied doing that. But what it means is that the well is quite dry, typically, when I'm not working. And so there isn't a lot there for painting, drawing, casual photography and that kind of thing, because I spend my creative well water on work. And so I think, which is okay. I just think, I guess I, it's as though, this is a strange metaphoric way to say that my hobbies have been somewhat usurped by work, but not in a bad way. It's just they've been translated into something that I make money off of. And that satisfies me creatively and professionally. And so as a result, I guess I just feel like I have less of a need to fulfill that satisfaction or to pull from the well outside of work. It doesn't feel as necessary to me as it was when I was not a working professional, in high school or as a child or even in college. So I think it's just something that changes and grows with time, but it's something that I do enjoy and I think it's worth being deliberate about as something to try and reintegrate into my lifestyle and my day-to-day, because I think it's good to derive pleasure and enjoyment from something that is not tied to finances, creatively, that is. So I think it just means a bit of a rebalance of making sure that I'm filling the well enough to be able to draw from it, also not at work, but also offset.
I love that.
And yeah. And again, filling the well, the activities that I do to fill the well, which is really just exposure to inspiration. And that exposure manifests itself in watching movies and TV. I watch pretty much one movie a day. And there's a lot of TV shows that I keep up with, going to museums, looking at art, looking at photographs, even just scrolling on Instagram and looking at photographs, photographers that I follow, reading certain things, traveling, seeing the world. Those obviously take a little bit more effort, but just going out into nature, all of those things inspire me and fill the well. But those activities also take time. And then you also have, you know, your life that you're living and your obligations. So, yeah, it's just, it'd be nice if we didn't have to sleep. Like, that's
if we didn't have to sleep, we would ask if we had a longer day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I think that's when you know your alignment with what you're doing.
Yeah.
You should be kind of in this limbo. You sound very self-aware. It sounds like you have a lot of internal dialogue that you process often to be self-aware.
It's nonstop.
Have you always been like this?
Yes.
So very very cerebral and very kind of.
Yes, cerebral, anxious, constantly thinking, overthinking, overthinking.
Yeah, you must have been quite fixating. Anxious when you were given this opportunity too, this bigger one that just recently happened too.
Well. Maybe nervous more than anxious, but nerves I think are good. Anxiety can be a burden, or I think is a burden, but nerves I think are good, because nerves are the positive manifestation of anxiety.
Oh, interesting.
Nerves are it's the inverse side of that coin. Like, anxiety is dread, or you know, fear of an outcome, whereas nerves is excitement. And if maybe only just a fear of disappointing someone or falling short of expectation. But I think that ultimately that's a good thing, because that's a motivator and something that drives creativity and drives, motivation. And I do thrive on that. I rely on that as well. So it's a double-edged sword, I think. You know, I'm also a perfectionist, always have been, and quite neat and tidy. And I think these are all related psychologically. So, you know, it's like, would I trade anxiety for not being a perfectionist and not having nerves? Probably not, because I think those latter two things are an asset to creativity, not a hindrance, whereas anxiety is just a hindrance to everything. But
suppose it's
comes with the territory. Yeah, exactly. And it's just about finding the self-balance. I'm at least conscious of it, which maybe is the first step at least.
Yeah, being conscious of who you are, how you operate, and what you do. I think acknowledging that, seeing that, there's this thing in Stoicism I've recently got into, is pretty interesting, about catastrophizing thoughts, you know, and if you become your own worst enemy by doing so. And I think it was Shakespeare that said, things are neither good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. I think that's what he said. And it's just like, fuck, man. It's beautiful. Also true. It's all self-fulfilling. Yeah.
That guy was onto stuff, wasn't he? He's a smart cookie.
Yeah. It's amazing when we, and it's so cool that we have records and traces of this person's existence that we can reflect on now and use as lessons. That's why I like Stoicism. God. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless they're all a myth and it was actually someone else and he ghostwrote it and took all the credit.
You never know. Yeah. And does it matter?
No.
If it's usable. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Authorship, I guess, is an interesting one. You mentioned the word perfectionism. This is something that comes up in quite a few conversations here on the podcast. I know a lot of people that listen to the podcast would identify with that trait in themselves. I've personally slowly tried to remove that aspect from me because I realized it became very toxic.
Yes.
Yeah. So how do you live with the concept of perfectionism?
Well, again, I think it's all about your relationship to it and awareness of it. So perfectionism is not in and of itself good or bad, like Shakespeare said.
But it's
it's our relationship to it that can be either positive or negative. Mm. And I think that the negative relationship to perfectionism is quite obvious and one that's probably relatable to a lot of people, which is being hard on yourself for falling short of your own perfectionist expectations that you set for your performance or whatever it is. Mm. But that's not, and that is not inherent to perfectionism. That is a trait of the self responding to perfectionism. Mm. Because there's another way of looking at perfectionism, which is as an aspirational motivator. And so to me, that's how I view perfectionism. Now, that's not to say that I don't fall into the other side of it sometimes, because it takes a lot of self-awareness and mindfulness to be aware of how you're reacting to perfectionism and what side of that coin you're on. Hmm. and catching yourself when you're on the other side of it. The negative side, the positive side of it to me, though, is I find perfectionism to be aspirational, but not cripplingly so. Like, it's something to aspire to and to motivate good work. And I see it as the antithesis to laziness. Like, perfectionism is just dedication. I mean, you could replace it with a different word, like dedication, focus, aspiring to greatness, aspiring to create something good, aspiring towards quality. I don't think any of those things are bad. As long as you have a relationship with it where you acknowledge that it's something that you're using as a motivator, not as a self-criticism tool. And as long as you find that balance, I do find it to be a positive thing. Mm. Like, you know, because the flip side of it, here's the important part of it. This is why I think it's good, is because another side of the tetrahedron of perfectionism is pride. And I mean the positive version of pride, not vanity, but pride in your work. Mm. And I take pride in my work, and I take pride in something being good. When I, like, the shelf behind me that I have arranged the objects on it in a designed fashion, I did so with an eye towards perfectionism and balance. And the result is I'm proud of the way it looks, and I enjoy its existence, and it's the way it reflects my interests and my travels and my personality and whatever. And so I feel that way about work as well, as that an aspiration towards perfectionism and quality is something that gives me a reason to be proud of it, because I care about it. And so I don't really have it as bad as I know a lot of people who will say, oh, I can't watch my work. All I see is the flaws, and I don't like looking back on past projects, and I just hate myself and all the decisions that I made, and I can't just step back and enjoy it for what it is. I don't have that. Mm. I am able, thankfully, to step back and enjoy and be proud of what I've done and my work. And if there's something that I'm not proud of, I probably just won't show it to anybody. And that's okay too. There's nothing wrong with that. And there's also still things, even in the work that I'm proud of, that I don't fully like, that I think were not as accomplished as I would have liked them to be. But I'm also aware that other people don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. And that nobody sees the flaws in your work the way that you do. And so therefore, it's really just something that's in your head. So anyway, this is kind of a long, rambly answer to this.
I love it.
Hopefully there's something relatable in there.
I love it. I mean, I know a lot of the interviews that you've done, they can sometimes remain very on the surface. This is wonderful because we're getting deeper into...
Oh, this is great. I love this. Yeah. This is an awesome conversation.
This is, in my opinion, this is why podcasts are this is the way you do a podcast. You kind of go cerebral with it and you get deeper into it.
Well, cerebral podcasts can certainly go cerebral. There's other people that want other things. So,
for sure. Totally.
You know, and you got to give them what they want. If some people just want reviews of the latest slider, they can get that on a podcast as well.
That's true. I guess it just depends on what you're after, truly. Yes. Yeah. But I love that. Yeah, this is an interesting thing. I really admire that about yourself, where you can look at the past version of yourself doing the best that you could at the time within constraints and limitations, whatever it might be, and still see pride in it. I mean, I guess pride is wrapped into the ego, but then being able to see it and not look at it as if it's a tarnish form, I guess, which is really beautiful. It's a self-acceptance, I suppose. And
Yeah.
do you look at it
Well,
like you can still
yeah.
grow from it? Obviously, but you look at it like, okay, I'm on the right course. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, pride is an interesting one because I think there's self-pride, which is driven by the ego, but you can also be proud of someone else, right?
It's true.
And you can feel that same feeling of warmth and satisfaction, whatever you want to call it, towards the success of somebody else or the achievement of somebody else, like a child or a friend or a loved one. In my case, I feel pride not just for myself when it's something that I'm happy with how it turned out. So that's the personal pride. But more than that, I feel pride for the accomplishment of the whole team that worked on a film. Like, especially with something like The Creator, like, I will always constantly say that I'm very proud of that film. And when I say that, I don't just mean I'm happy with how it looks and how it turned out, which I am. But one level above that is I'm just proud of the accomplishment of everybody that worked on it. And everyone worked on it really hard. So I'm proud of Gareth. I'm proud of the visual effects team, a lot of whom are my friends. I mean, we all became close when we made the film. So I'm proud of the production designer and I'm proud of the film itself. I mean, obviously it's an inanimate object, but you know, I do ascribe an emotional connection to every project that I've worked on. Like they all kind of feel like my children. So I feel a pride towards them the same way that I would a person, which is maybe, I don't know how I feel about that, but that is how I feel. So
Honest.
there's an aspect of that too, where I'm just proud of the film and what it is and its own accomplishments as a movie, you know, as a cinephile watching it. And I think that's part of it too, is yeah, the larger pride.
Yeah, I could see that. And that's a beautiful thing too, being able to look at it with that lens.
Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, when you are a part of a when you're a part of something so large as a film or any of these kind of things, you cannot be disillusioned by the idea that it's done within you. It's there's definitely you're an aspect of it, but there is such a greater version of it that it comes from the culmination of multiple people working very hard.
Exactly. And I think that's where the phrase, and I would say this too, is I'm proud to have been a part of it. You know, it's not just, I'm not just proud of the work, I'm proud of the experience and all of it. Like it fills me with great personal satisfaction and a warm feeling of accomplishment. And that's ultimately, I think, it's not what drives artists, but it is an aspect of art that I think is important, is you know, I think anyone would be lying to themselves if they say that they only create for an audience of one, as in the self. But there is an aspect of wanting, and I don't think it's negative. I think it's a natural desire to want to share. Art is a form of expression. And so you want to share it. You want to share your emotion, your experience, your expression, whatever, with
Your inner language,
with an audience. And so that is a part of art, the relationship to the viewer, the audience, the reader, whatever it is, you know, whatever art form you're working in is there is an aspect of it that is the relationship to the audience. So the feeling of pride, part of it comes from that relationship and that success of that relationship. So
I love that. The exchange. Yeah, that's
the
awesome.
exchange, 100%. It is. It's a part of it. You know, it's a part of it. What, you know, why was it so Vincent van Gogh? Well, he had so psychological issues, but you know, part of the tragedy of him is that he wasn't really able to I mean, his art just didn't really find an audience, and I think that can be very hard on an artist. You know, not that he needed to be some big success, and again, obviously, I don't know much about him, but what little I know is that you have to have some sort of psychological damage to cut your ear off and do what he did and whatever. But
it's a piece of his ear, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, a piece. Yeah, yeah. Chunk.
Yeah.
And then, but that's neither here nor there. It's sure. It's useful as a metaphor, I think, for an artist and the relationship to the audience, like similar to Shakespeare. Like there's a mythos around it that I think is we can learn from, even if the reality is probably more mundane and boring. But
yeah,
it was a long time ago, so it's
yeah. Well, I think that's the reason why he's still a figure of speech, like discussion, because of the relevancy to that form of artists that didn't have. I remember one of. I think it was Craig Mullins. He's a fantastic, he was one of the legacy digital artists of the era. And I had him on the podcast. He has said this really wonderful thing is that he feels that everybody as an artist has this thing within them. They just need the module to unlock them, you know? And he just like, so let's say you grew up and you really wanted to be an illustrator, but you just never had that thing that made you a good illustrator. But then you pick up a camera and that modular to reconnect you quickly to the thing that you needed. And you're just able to get after it, and then you're able to exchange and show it in free flow. I think it's really fascinating, the idea that if you're willing to just open yourself up to opportunities, you can maybe potentially find a module to unlock you, basically.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Gives me hope. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We live in an interesting time in society where, I mean, we're going to talk, I want to actually switch a little bit and talk about how all this stuff is evolving. I imagine you've been keeping up with a little bit of what's going on with, like, say, AI and image generation and all that kind of stuff, and the Sora stuff. And I'm actually really curious. You sound very self-aware, and it sounds like you've kind of figuring out some certain things. What's the internal dialogue when you see stuff like that happening?
I want to kill it with hammers.
Yeah? Yeah, just let's get into that then. Describe it.
To me, it's anti- art. I mean, it's anti-creativity, and there's this very specific reason why. Mm. It actually goes back to the Star Wars fandom conversation. Mm. When you haven't unlocked that potential, the thing you were just talking about, and you feel limited for some reason in your artistic expression, you feel like you rely on external sources to validate your own creative motivation. And as a result, you end up ascribing a lot of meaning to things that are not your expression. Like the Disney Star Wars shows are not Chad from Mississippi's expression. That's the artist that worked on its expression. And when Chad gets angry and upset because something in that show isn't what he imagined, it's a reaction to the frustration of not having unlocked that artistic potential within, because you're ascribing an external creator or an external factor, your own personal artistic ambition. And the truth is that there's nothing really stopping anybody from unlocking that within themselves. It just takes self-awareness, just time, themselves. Discipline, wherewithal. Yeah. Themselves. So like this whole idea, for example, I mean, I'm jumping around a little bit, but the point is, the larger point is that text-to-image generator, large language models, diffusion models, all of these things, to me, they are sort of the manifestation of the artistic and creative shortcut of just skipping around the part where I find a way to express myself creatively, and instead, I have to rely on an external source to express myself creatively. I have creative thoughts and I have creative ideas, but instead of looking within to find out how I can unlock them, I type them into a machine and then the machine can create it for me. And to me, it's just the death of art, like the creative process. And it's a shame because I think everybody has that potential, exactly like you said. And when I see online discourse around this stuff, you have the camps are, you know, quote unquote, what people would call AI bros, to sort of use an umbrella term, people who are just very pro Runway, Sora, Midjourney, whatever. And there's a lot of antagonism from those people towards artists. There's this feeling that artists are gatekeeping artistry and creativity, when the truth is nobody's gatekeeping artistry or creativity. You, anybody, can decide, I'm going to learn art right now. I don't feel comfortable or confident in drawing a figure. Well, you can learn how. You don't even need to pay money. There's all these free resources now. The internet has never been more accessible in terms of classes, YouTube, WikiHow. I mean, it just takes practice and discipline and the wherewithal to say, I have a creative idea, instead of being frustrated and basing its manifestation on external sources. I can learn ways and find ways to express it myself. But in this modern world, we're always looking for shortcuts and quick answers and, you know, solutions to things. So to me, the quote unquote AI, I don't even like using that term when we're talking about this stuff.
It's not really AI either.
Because it's not really AI, exactly. Yeah. So, but colloquially, that's what it's referred to. So sure. I guess, you know, I have to begrudgingly accept that.
Coin another term for it. Yeah.
I think we should. I mean, large language model diffusion, it's like it's... It's accurate, but it doesn't really mean something to a lot of people. So we have to come up with something else.
Yeah.
But this is, by the way, part of the problem. There's a branding problem with this too.
Communication
but anyway,
problem too.
100%. The larger issue is exactly this, is that to me, it is a shortcut to circumventing the creative process.
Yeah.
And
it's depriving.
And that's exactly. And it's a shame. Now, that's not to say that there are not very obvious and very strong use cases for the technology. I, for example, have become very much in tune and have embraced generative fill in Photoshop, which is a great tool because it uses machine learning and it uses the same technology, AI, quote unquote, large language diffusion models, et cetera, to create a more efficient way to do a menial task that would otherwise take a lot of time and not so much artistic expression to achieve. So for example, I took a photo yesterday. It was a nice photo, but there was a person right behind my head that kind of was a little distracting. Prior to generative fill, I could go through a very menial process of clone stamping and adjusting this background to remove that person. And this is just photo editing as it's existed for digitally for, you know, since Photoshop was invented in the 80s.
Sure.
Now, here's a technological tool that allows me to do not an artistic process, but a menial process quicker and more efficiently, because there isn't really much artistic intent in removing a person from the background besides the idea of I want a better image by removing that person. And then the technical process of doing that is the menial task that can be made more efficient with this tool. Sora, Runway, the video versions of it. There's a lot of applications that I can see as tools to assist filmmakers to help make certain processes more efficient. I mean, talk about Dune. I just read that in Dune Part 2, the VFX house DNEG used machine learning for eye tracking to do the blue eyes. So there's so many characters in the film, Fremen, that have to have blue eyes because of their spice usage. And up until this technology's development and existing, that's a process you would have to do manually. Like in the 80s, you would have to hand draw
each frame
blue on the film frames, frame by frame. And then with the advent of digital visual effects tools, you can now do that in the computer, but you still have to hand track it onto everybody. So it's not frame by frame, but it's still shot by shot. Whereas now you have a tool that you can leverage in order to make that menial process more efficient, leaving room for more creative process. But it only works if you leave room for the creative process. If your goal is to replace the creative process, I don't see the point. And in fact, more so than that, I see it as a direct threat to somebody, excuse me,
salute,
like myself, grazie, who relies on the creative process, not just for personal fulfillment, nourishment, but also for work. So it's tricky. It's tricky. And it's not going anywhere. The genie is not going back in the bottle. But I think it's on us as a society, as artists, as creatives, as professionals, et cetera, to determine for ourselves what is the tool for, what are the guidelines of it for ourselves, what is good use of it, ethical use, and what is antithetical to everything that we do. Mm-hmm. So I guess all that to say is, the more specific answer is, I don't have any fundamental issue with the underlying technology. It's the way that we choose to use it and the way that others choose to use it that is going to be the determining factor of whether or not it's a force of good or a force of or a destructive force on society. But I think that a world in which human created art does not exist and is completely usurped and replaced by algorithmically generated art that is remixing the existing canon of human existing art, or then starts remixing itself, is a world devoid of meaning, because we, you know, humans have been expressing ourselves with art and storytelling and visual and oral storytelling for since we came down from the trees. So I think it's essential to our very humanity, not to put too, you know, grand a point on it, but I do largely feel that way. So
yeah, no, I mean, this is your opinion and this is your thought on it. And I'm sure it sways at times too, just like mine does and everybody else too. There's you tend to look into it, and then my first reaction is almost tends to be the fear-based reaction. Then I ask myself why I'm having the fear-based reaction, and I start to go through those conversations internally, and I realize, okay, X, Y, Z, this is why this, I feel this and this and that, and so on and so forth, the anxiety, the threat of it potentially, but then ultimately just the sadness that occurs when you think about that people just don't value themselves and others. And it's just sad.
Well, exactly. And I think that that's the saddest thing about it, is it's just this devaluation of art and skill, and you know, it's tricky because there's certain allegorical examples that you can point to. For like, the biggest one in the film industry is probably the advent of CGI and computer, you know, generated visual effects in the first place, which in terms of its net result on the industry did kill off essentially an entire valuable skill set that of artists and artisans, of model making, miniatures, matte paintings, practical effects, like all sorts of things like that, that unfortunately, you know, the heyday of that craft has gone away because it was replaced by a different form of artistry. I mean, CG is still very much artistry. It's just, it manifests itself differently. Or even something like animation. I mean, the artistic principles of animation are still very much present in computer generated animation. The principles of storytelling, movement, dynamics, editing, visuals, composition, like none of that changes. But what you do lose is just the physical craft of hand-drawn imagery, right? And so unfortunately, with technological advancement, there are certain things, disciplines, art forms, and forms of expression that do evolve with time. And it sort of is what it is. But you know, so I do have to check myself and make sure that my reaction to generated imagery is not the reaction of a special effects makeup artist when CGI came around, you know, like, and it is not just a knee jerk, but is actually a reaction to the fundamental core tenet of the thing itself. And I do think that I am confident in my personal feelings about it. But again, it's really my feelings towards the way certain people use or talk about using it versus the technology itself. Mm-hmm. And I understand that certain aspects of filmmaking will inevitably change and grow and evolve. But if the intent of artistic expression is still there, I think that's what matters. I mean, even if we end up moving to a world where we're no longer putting a physical box in front of a physical set and capturing photons, like in terms of live action capture, I mean, I suppose one could imagine some such future.
So not fulfilling,
probably down the road.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's maybe there is something lost there, but there's still artistic expression and intent of doing so in a virtual world, right? Like, as long as that's not lost, I think the art form stays alive, even though, yeah, it would be sad to lose the discipline of shooting on set. And me personally, I can't imagine losing that discipline for myself and my own desires in filmmaking in the same way that Chris Nolan and Spielberg and P.T. Anderson and Quentin and all these people can't imagine not shooting on celluloid film, which is generational. I mean, I certainly have no emotional attachment to celluloid because I grew up in the digital age. So for me, I'm just neutral on it. Like, I think any acquisition format is cool. And I think whatever's right for the job. And I personally tend to gravitate towards digital out of familiarity and comfort and efficiency of the workflow. But that's not to say that I don't understand where other people are coming from. And it's also not to say that these other people are not managing to keep their discipline alive, which I think is a good thing. So that gives me hope, I suppose, that there will always be people who love the act of movie making and filmmaking and are going to keep that alive in one way or another. And so, you know, that's nice, but I worry about the commerce side of it. I worry about commercials. I worry about anything that really is boiled down to the bottom line where there, you know, really is already barely any artistic expression there in the first place.
Yeah, so those things, I'm feeling like that would be the low-hanging fruit to just be like, if you were an agency, you have no creativity and you just want to synthesize the next Snickers commercial, then yeah, run it through the AI generator, you know?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And unfortunately, that will have dire financial repercussions to a lot of artisans in the industry. And
absolutely. But should they be doing that? I mean, I don't know. That's another conundrum I run into is that when I'm a child making things, the last thing I ever thought I wanted to do was make a Snickers commercial. But then you do it for commercial sake, you know? So there's a lot. It's so unraveling, you know?
It is. Yeah, it is. Yeah, so, yeah, it kind of is what it is. I mean, ultimately, you know, I'd be very satisfied if I could just make films and tell stories, but there's still financial obligations in life, and I think, you know, it is what it is. We have to accept that, but
yeah, it's definitely a journey. Well, that one of the things that gave me my own kind of solace with all of this stuff is that I had beta tested Midjourney and Stable Diffusion before this public did, so I lifted the carpet and went, oh my god. And so for the first week I was using it, I was just like bombarded by it, putting things into it, this and that. And then what I realized what was happening is in the beginning, it was this beautiful, like felt like a magic trick. And then what had happened is once I did the cycle, I mean, this could just be because I know who I am, what I do and why I do it. Then I realized, I kind of like doing it the other way, but I'm thankful that this exists. I'm happy that so I had all this, and I just stopped using it. I just was like, well, when you're given the keys to the kingdom, in my opinion, this is its own kingdom. You can go, okay, cool, but like, I'm just gonna go back to my cabin, you know?
Yeah.
And the woods.
Yeah. And by the way, I felt that way too. I used Midjourney when it came out and experimented, and at first, it really is, like a very impressive magic trick, and then
you
sort of see the trick.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you see the trick, and then you're like, oh. It just does the same. Like once you've seen even the most impressive magic trick in the world, like you see David Blaine, you know, pull a folded slice of card out of an orange, and then you're and you don't know how the trick is done. That will mesmerize you every time. But the minute you know how it's done, he could do it 100 times. That could be his entire act, and it just isn't interesting anymore. And that's what I felt about Mitch, because it's the same trick.
It's the same trick. I say it's like the biggest ruby in the jewelry store, but it's made out of plastic, and from afar you're like, damn, that thing is the biggest jewel here, but then you look closer like, ah, and then you realize the diamond next to it that's real is more beautiful.
Yes, I agree, and I think that I feel the same about Sora and any video version of the same thing. I mean, as impressive as it is, I know the trick.
I will say I was at a friend's studio, and he has beta to Sora, and it's not as impressive as I think that they put on to be. And they're doing this as a, in my opinion, to stimulate capital. But it's like ultra smoke and mirrors, all being held by tape.
Very much so.
So they're using these models that are, that it's like that you can write in a script that you want, but it'll add GPT to it to refine your script. And then it's using, they were using, in my understanding, Unreal Engine base movements basically and things to then write over it. And then it's just like, it's not nearly as impressive once you understand the magic trick again.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And so it's then not the question becomes,
I was like, okay, I'm not really worried about this. This is actually not very impressive in a lot of ways. It's cool and impressive in certain ways, but it's not really impressive. You're not going to replace me anytime soon, potentially.
No. Maybe. And I guess that's, so it goes back to like, what I'm worried about isn't the technology. Mm. It's how people react to it and use it.
Yeah.
And so it's like everything you just described is true, but it's not going to stop somebody who doesn't care about quality of using it as a shortcut. Yeah. That's what worries me, is the human, the what feels like a very modern, I mean, I don't know, I'm young, so I don't have a frame of reference, but what feels to me like a very modern internet age driven desire that humans have to constantly find shortcuts and quicker avenues and easy solutions, and it manifests itself in so many tiny little ways that I see in my day to day. Like, people just don't even bother reading things or looking at things, and there's just this constant expectation of like an immediate answer, an immediate satisfaction, an immediate solution to something.
Yeah.
And it's just not a way to live. We're not designed to live that way, but somehow we've tricked ourselves into living in a world where we expect that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think this harkens back to just the way that we use the technology now. I've used this analogy multiple times, but I think we're going to look back at social media and how we interact with it like we do with cigarettes now.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's a mental sickness, and it's not helping our situation. We're, if anything, we're becoming, that's why I said it's so good to read or have personal time or time with yourself. And this is why I love photography.
Yeah.
Photography gives me the ability to be an artist anywhere I want, as long as I have the camera and I can just see the world, and then I can be present with the world. And it's so beautiful because there's this building and then the light changes. Like, wow, look at that. And then if I wasn't present for the moment to be in that setting of mind frame, I wouldn't have been able to see that beauty. And you're just humbled by it. It's just like the world at large. And that's deeply why I love cinematography, and that's why I love photography, and all these things are just so fantastic and such a beautiful blessing to give yourself. That's why I always tell anybody, any day, anytime, photography, this and that. I'm like, literally, you could pick up any camera, even a Rebel, and you could just go and have fun.
Even this.
Even your phone. Yeah. Which,
even this. Yeah. They're so good now. I told somebody this anecdote already today, but last night I was at the ASC Awards. And I shared a photo of it from on Instagram of just a group of people on the red carpet. And then one of the people in the photo responded to me, and she said, "Oh, how did you get the professional photos from the ASC photographer so quickly?" And I said, "This isn't a professional photo. It was on my phone."
Yeah.
But it's just goes to show, like, well, yes, but I mean, she was referring to the quality. Technical quality of the photo.
Yeah.
And it just shows that, like, look at what they've given us, like what they've put in our pocket in a good way.
Yeah.
Like, I think that this is huge. Yeah. Like, this is to have access to, you don't even need, it's like, talk about gatekeeping and barriers. Like, we all have it. We all have the camera. We all have something that can create amazing images in our pocket all day.
Yeah.
You know, there really is, there's never been less of an excuse, right?
Yeah.
To just go out and observe the world and capture it through your eye and your perspective and your lens, because there's no technical barrier there. Every year it gets less and less there. Like, we just, the power of these cameras and how small they are now and how ubiquitous it is. I mean, to me, it's exciting. It's just really cool that I don't have to be deliberate, for example, of taking my giant medium format digital Fuji camera around with me everywhere I go, because obviously I take it on trips and on set and when I am being intentionally deliberate. But to answer even just your question earlier about going out on a little photo journey, like, I guess I sort of do that all the time anyway, because I have my iPhone with me all the time and I'm constantly taking photos.
You
get fulfillment wherever
for
I am.
Those photos?
Yes. Because I will only take it out and take a photo if I see a photo.
Sure.
Like, if I see an image,
moment, yeah.
at a moment or light coming in a certain way in a certain time, mm-hmm. then I'll capture it. But it's nice to just be able to do that at all times. And I do get fulfillment every time I do it. Mm-hmm. So it's cool.
That is cool. Interesting. I admire that. The phone for some reason cheapens the experience for me. And I feel like they're just for me personally.
Yeah.
That's why I'm looking to invest. Like, I mean, after talking with you and Greg, I got on the Fuji train because I just absolutely love the way that this system works. I never really knew it.
Oh, I love it. Don't get me wrong.
I shoot JPEGs only now, and it's all on camera, and I build my own recipes, and it's fantastic. If it's really important, I'll shoot JPEG and RAW just so I can post-grade. Because I enjoy the post-grade process too. But there's some times where I just want to be present, and I just want to capture it, and I don't want to do anything after that. And there's this beautiful, it's almost like being more in the moment. So now I'm searching for a nice used XE4 basically, or XE3 mm-hmm. potentially, just so I can have a small little pancake, put in your pocket, go with it. And it's just a tool to open you up to communicate. And really what I feel with photography in that form is just how vulnerable are you willing to be in that moment? How mm-hmm. willing are you to see? I'm not a religious person, but I feel like it's like you're witnessing God, or you're witnessing the beauty of life. And you're just trying to capture that essence and share it to the world. Don't forget that this shit fucking matters. Don't lose this, you know?
Yeah, I like that.
That's at least how I look at it. When you're working, I know we're going to run out of time here and we just barely scratched the surface on these things.
Sorry, it's just going on a lot of tangents.
Potentially, maybe if you're up for it, we'll do a part two at some point.
Oh, I definitely am. I'd love that.
Appreciate your kindness with your time. I know you're very busy. One of the things that I imagine has got to be a bit of a conundrum is being on set, the just all of the chaos that potentially is occurring around you, and then being able to capture that moment. How are you doing that in tandem with, say, one when you're with Gareth and you're working out on different locations, and then you got to get the day and you have all these things happening? How are you staying present to capture what he needs and the crew needs?
It's hard. That's, I think, maybe the great challenge of filmmaking, especially at a higher level, is you have to strike that balance, and it's hard. And sometimes one thing gets sacrificed over the other. The higher priority is staying present. So I think it's just about creating that hierarchical priority and making sure that you're cognizant of it, and also having a team, other crew. You know, your gaffer, your key grip, your DIT, maybe if you're lucky, your assistant, to be there as a support system to help with the larger responsibilities so that you can then focus on staying present for the moment, because staying present for the moment is the more important part, because that's why you're there. You're there to capture the moment. And for me, at least, I know I'm sure a lot of artists relate to this. I get into a trance when you're focused on in a moment, or when you're operating a shot or framing something. Like, it's actually very easy for everything else to fall off. So again, that's where it's sometimes to a fault, because you do still need awareness of other needs and other, you can't just ignore the machinery of filmmaking that's happening around you. So it's just about being aware and cognizant of when you're in the zone and in the moment, and when you have sort of set aside time for that, and you're saying, okay, for the next 30 minutes, I know we're going to be in the zone. I've addressed the things that I need to address. Things can be happening in the background while I'm in the zone, and then I'll check in on them after. So it's kind of just negotiating that, like, all the time, but there is a way. But yeah, it's hard, and it's, you take it moment by moment.
Yeah. Cause seems like we have a similar affinity for remove, distill, use one light if at all possible, and capture the world as its natural form.
Yes, one lens, one light, small camera, small footprint, small crew.
I love that.
All of that helps, because it's just fewer things that you need to address.
Fewer things to need to address, fewer things that could potentially go wrong, and you can keep it nimble. I love watching what you guys have done. I know Gareth comes from a scrappy way of filmmaking, which is just get after it, use the best tool that's going to create less friction so you can just get from point A to point B. Did you glean a lot from this experience, I'm imagining? It's just so much. Just, it's like film school and full power.
It was like advanced film school. Like, it's a level that only, you know, you have to go through like Scientology levels of unlocking the next. you need to go through the 8 levels until you get to the higher level that you unlock. That's what it felt like. But it was amazing. I mean, I learned so much, and it was really a life-changing experience.
Yeah, I know it's probably a lot to unpack. I know we got to wrap it here. Is there something that's on the horizon that you're most excited about, and can you talk about that? Or
nothing really. I'm looking for my next narrative project.
How do you pick these projects?
It's a good question because there's a lot of different factors. But what I would like to be the main factor is, and this is the tricky thing, is it's hard to know this in advance.
You never can know.
Yeah, you can't really. But what you would like to do is to pick the projects that you would want to watch as a cinephile.
Oh, yeah.
Because to me, I'm first and foremost a cinephile. So I like watching movies, and I love good films and quality films. And you would want to pick projects to work on that are that kind of film that you as a cinephile would enjoy. As an audience member. So that's really the main thing. But again, it's hard to know in advance for sure if something's going to be good or not, or if you're going to like it or not. So you just have to hedge your bets, basically, and you never know. But, you know, there's certain factors that
good director, visionary, you know, these kind of things that usually
happen. And those are really the main ones. It's like if there's a good script and a visionary director.
That's a good person, too, first and foremost, that can communicate and isn't cruel.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So I've found that those tend to go hand in hand with very few exceptions.
Yeah.
That are really exceptions to the rule. But yeah, that's really what it comes down to. And I think that that's the number one priority. Usually quality kind of stems from that, but
yeah, it always grows. It's a place to grow.
Yeah,
You watch a lot of films. Do you have any top 3 films that you've watched recently that you would recommend to the rest of us? And I have a film I'll recommend to you.
Oh yeah. Well, recently, let's see. Let me just look at my Letterboxd recently watched diary and see if anything pops out. Well, I did watch this little movie called Dune Part 2 the other day. I thought that was pretty neat.
Yeah, it's just a small movie.
I watched Powell and Pressburger's A Matter of Life and Death for the first time recently. It's actually a film that's not really available. So it was on the Criterion Channel this past month. It was also released by Criterion, so you can get it on Blu-ray. Just stunning. I mean, I'd heard so many things about this. For those who maybe are more familiar with their more famous film, The Red Shoes, that's Powell and Pressburger, and they also did Black Narcissus, which is a masterpiece. Matter of Life and Death is another one of their sort of metaphysical films that I had never seen, but it really is stunning. And I mean, talk about creativity and visual expression, like these two directors are maybe at the top of the game. And this is in the 1940s. So, you know, it's very early cinema, relatively speaking, to the existence of the medium, and they were really pushing the boundaries of it. So yeah, really inspired by that. I also recently saw Rebecca for the first time, Alfred Hitchcock. That was on a Nitrate film print at the Egyptian Theater. So that was really cool to see. I mean, it doesn't really look very different. It's just a very pristine black and white film print, but yeah, that was really cool. And I also recently deep dived the filmography of Michael Mann. There's a few films I hadn't seen, including Manhunter, which
Manhunter's fantastic.
Yeah, and I thought it was a masterpiece. I just hadn't seen it. Yeah. But
it's so a weird good. Sleeping giant. People really don't realize that film has incredible potential. Yeah, and
are totally sleeping on it. Yeah, and then I also recently watched Point Break. Rewatched Point Break.
You've seen it before, though, right?
Yeah. But I hadn't seen it in a long time, it was a rewatch, and it was
Catherine's,
I think,
film,
the first
right?
time. Yeah, it's Catherine Bigelow, yeah. And it's the first time I'd ever seen it in good quality. Like I think the last time I saw it was like on a 4x3 cropped VHS tape or something. So I was like seeing it in HD.
That's great,
and you know, it was great. I love that film, so, and I really loved it this time.
It's
so yeah,
totally a thing. That's a big span of things. I have
more than 3 films, but
yeah, I love that. I'm gonna check these out. Thank you. One last film I'll recommend to you, and we'll wrap this. Is have you seen the film Cure?
No.
Uh huh. Yeah. Yes, this is a slept on film. It's basically like Seven, but done from Japan in a sense, but not Seven. It's much more cerebral.
Oh, Seven. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
It's very, very good. It's one of my like top 10 films of all time.
Wow, Kiyoshi Kurosawa. Well, I'm adding this to my list right now.
Please let
That's
me know
fantastic.
after you watch it. It's a watch that you would watch it, and it's a film that you would watch, and then you would have a lot of questions and think about it, and then you would watch again, and then again and again. It's a film I recommend watching twice a year. You
Wow,
get so much from it,
fabulous.
for me personally. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Thanks for the recommendation.
Thank
Yeah, I
you for the
just put it right
recommendation.
at the top of my list.
Amazing. Hopefully you enjoy it. Please let me know.
Will
Thank
do.
you so much, Warren. I appreciate you and your time. Thank you for sharing your art with us and being so kind with with everything that you're doing. It's fantastic. And yeah,
Thank
just
you.
wanted to say thank you. We're all
All
thankful for
right.
you.
Yeah, wow. Thanks. I appreciate it. We're thankful for you. And this is great. And yeah, let me know about part two. I'd love
Absolutely.
to keep going.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.